Hello, how are you? We meet again Monday afternoon. Dialogue Conspiracy. This was the week that was. That's the name of a record from the week that John Kennedy was assassinated, that terrible week where Ruby was killed, the president was killed, Officer Tippit was killed just 10 years ago almost. The cataclysmic events, the news coming down this week is so fantastic, it's hard to put it in its proper perspective or priority. I'll run down just a couple of comments. The movie The Second Gun opened in New York City. I told you it would last week. It took 5 years to get this movie produced, made by Theodore Chirac and Gerald Alcon. It got a fairly good review in the New York Times. It shows the question of the second gun being in the Ambassador Hotel and the fact that Sirhan did not kill Senator Robert Kennedy. It didn't make the headlines. It didn't make the front pages. It was just a movie review. It's called The Second Gun, and everything about the Watergate, the corruption, government isn't related to this movie. Nobody cared to pick that up of what happened when a candidate in 1968 was murdered. But it did open the same way in Boston. It opened at the Translux, and the advertisement says, the five-year filmed investigation of the assassination of Robert Kennedy. And it's playing now in New York and Boston, like any other movie, not the cataclysmic event to American society that it actually was. The Vice President Spiro Agnew stepped down from office. I hesitated. I wanted to use some other words maybe I shouldn't use on the air. Hank Greenspan, the publisher from Las Vegas, called him a foul, cheap crook. There were a lot of words that have been put out that he was not the heroic, self-sacrificing vice president. People think he is. Democratic Chairman Robert Strauss said he didn't serve his nation. He negotiated his resignation so he wouldn't go in prison, and we hope they don't make a hero out of him. Another author, writer, Mike Royka, had something to say in the Washington Post about Spiro Agnew. He remembers an interview he had with Agnew a year ago when Agnew took him on the carpet for writing something about him that he didn't like. And this particular newspaper man said that in the course of their conversation, Agnew was talking about the poorest people in America and bullying them around. And this particular Mike Royka said to him, well, couldn't you once talk about the big fat cats who cheat on their income taxes? And he says, now I tried to get some kind of response from him, even an angry one, but he didn't say anything. There was nothing to say, and now I find out that he's been cheating on his income tax. I'd like to think that at that moment he might have recognized what a hypocrite he was, and I have no sympathy for him if he failed to pay taxes on the money that he earned, but he didn't even earn it. He likes to preach about people supporting themselves through honest, hard work, but the money he got amounted to graft, kickbacks out of the hands of contractors, the governor of Maryland. He sweated for the money. It wasn't from honest labor, but from nervousness in case he would get caught. It was money he did nothing to earn except by abusing the highest position of trust and power in the land. He could stand up in public and sneer at women who might hide the fact they made a few bucks a month babysitting because they were afraid the welfare payments would reduce. He sneered at people who bent the rules set up by bureaucrats because they're trying to get their family through another day, another meal, living at the bottom of every social and economic ladder we have in this country. He would sneer at people who cheat, using his own words, only when they were really trying to survive. To survive, he not only went playing golf with Frank Sinatra at the Millionaire Resort home in Palm Springs, but he built a palatial home for himself. He bought land down at St. Croix Condominium. He sneered at them, calling them. Those are the poor in this nation. And, well, he stuffed his pockets like a Chicago alderman, and one step further and cheated the government out of its share of the graft. He could sneer at them for the cynical purpose of playing upon the country's worst prejudices for political reasons for his own future. So Mr. Royka says, I can't feel any more compassion for him than he showed for the people who never had a chance to live a good life. I hope Agnew doesn't try to blame the downfall on the press. No reporter told him to take money from contractors. No reporters told him to cheat on his income tax. The advice he got from the press is the same that the press has given to politicians ever since this country began. It was simple enough. Play it honest and remember you're working for the people. If he took that advice, he'd be teeing off without a worry on his mind. There isn't more to say about Spiro Agnew on my part today, because there's some more important matters on this peninsula I want to talk about that in regards to investigations in Washington. A successor was appointed. He hasn't been passed yet through the Rules Committee in Washington. There are several committees investigating. The Judiciary is one committee. I'll give you homework to write to. And the Rules Committee in Washington, D.C., Chairman Howard Cannon of Nevada is the head of the Rules Committee. Birch Bayh is on that. And Representative Robert Kastenmeier and a group of very fine people are on the Judiciary Committee, and you can write to them about the appointment of Gerald Ford. Now, I'm very prejudiced. My opinion, if you ask me what do I think about Senator Ford as a vice president, because he easily could become president of the United States, I have to tell you that my opinion is very prejudiced, because it was Gerald Ford who was on the Warren Commission. And any man who had anything to do with the Warren Commission was a CIA espionage team that was put into position to hide the truth of the conspiracy that killed the President of the United States. Everything that's happened since that date, as I say, almost 10 years ago, has brought a cataclysmic change into this country. And after I spent years researching the John Kennedy assassination and reading the minutes of the meetings that Gerald Ford attended and going into the documentary evidence of the clothing and the ballistics and all the factors of the John Kennedy assassination, it would seem impossible to me that the people in this country would accept Gerald Ford's opinion about truth in government or honesty in government. He may not have made $1 million off of lying about the Warren Report or about Lee Harvey Oswald, but he certainly catapulted himself into a position where he could become president of the United States. And that accrues quite a bit of wealth in time, when we don't know where he'll go, whether he'll remain on the ticket or we will have election as time goes on, depending upon chaos in this country or war in the Middle East. A lot of factors could keep him in the White House now. But Gerald Ford was a member of the Warren Commission, made up of Chief Justice Earl Warren, Senator Richard Russell, Senator John Cooper, Representative Hale Boggs, Mr. Alan Dulles of the CIA, and John J. McCloy of the CIA Foundations. He was the gentleman who went to the very first meeting in December of 64, and the subject came up, what are we going to do? What are we going to say to the press? They're going to want to know about our work. And Ford said, well, this is a practical problem. He said, I can handle the AP and the UP and the network people, but our local people want a personal story, so it's a little different. And they had a discussion on how to handle the local people. When the subject matter came up, were they going to print the report? Because at first the Warren Report was going to be a government investigation. There was never a report on the shooting of Robert Kennedy. The subject came up, and Congressman Ford said, who gets this report? And Mr. Katzenbach, the Attorney General at the time, said, I say that with complete sincerity, if the FBI goofed, if the Secret Service goofed, if the Dallas police goof, if anybody makes errors and mistakes, we want the commission to make that judgment. But the members of the commission decided that every name would be put on the Warren Report so that no man would be responsible for the goofs. Representative Boggs said, in connection with the word goof, in regards to Secret Service, the FBI, the Dallas police, can we be objective when they bring these to our attention, their own goofs? And Mr. Katzenbach said, but all these departments are involved one way or another. All of them had something to do, at least with Lee Harvey Oswald, if not facts relating to the assassination. And Congressman Ford said, well, what state officials, if any, will be given this report? None, I assume. Now, that is the very first meeting, December the 5th, and they're hoping that nobody sees their rotten Warren Report. After it came out, you can understand why. After the Warren Report was going on for a few months and they were investigating and interviewing witnesses, June 64 rolled around and there was a leak about Life magazine publishing part of Lee Harvey Oswald's diaries. They were fictitious. It's a fictitious diary. It was a phony diary. It was made out to make him look like a village idiot, which he wasn't. They traced the leaks, and Mr. Gerald Ford had been in New York City with the editors of Life magazine, and they had come back to Washington and met with him, and the story of the lone individual and so forth came through various leaks that Gerald Ford had with the persons at Life magazine. I bring that out now because it's so typical of the leaks of Charles Colson with the DM papers, where he brings Life magazine to see them. Life magazine covered all the lies and cover stories of the political assassinations. It was Gerald Ford who had dinner with Mr. John Dowd, general counsel for Life magazine. And then they made another visit in Washington with him. And this was several weeks previous to where the article was to come out, the fictitious article about Lee Harvey Oswald. Gerald Ford also wrote his name to a book. He wrote a book called The Portrait of an Assassin. And it's written by Gerald Ford, the author now. He's like E. Howard Hunt, the author. And he co-authors the book with John R. Stiles, who was Gerald Ford's first campaign manager. So Gerald Ford becomes, from his military service and his football career, he becomes a author of The Portrait of the Assassin, which came out in 1965, 1 year after the Warren Report came out. Now, it's interesting, this book on The Portrait of the Assassin, because I think I know as much about Lee and Rena Oswald as anybody in the United States at this point, based upon 8 years of research into 30 particular witnesses, 34 witnesses, that I spent 8 years cross-filing in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, breaking down their relationship to Army intelligence and to government contracts and the military CIA operation. These 34 people that I spent 8 years cross-filing, and I have 28,000 typewritten pages on them, there were 34 witnesses. Gerald Ford attended the hearings where they gave their testimony about Lee and Rena Oswald, three witnesses. Three out of 34 witnesses he attended. Now, when the minutes of the meetings were made up and the Warren Commission was getting ready to subpoena witnesses or have hearings, they decided that two or more members of the Warren Commission would attend witness testimony. That's equivalent. Now, the Senate Select Committee has a team of men sitting up at the table listening to every witness, asking questions in front of each other. The Warren Commission had lawyers asking 552 witnesses, and very few members of the commission were present at any of these meetings. The witnesses that he attended, one was Mr. Peter Gregory. Peter Gregory was the source of contacts on a Dallas family tree that I have where Oswald was to make his chain of command and his meetings in the Dallas-Fort Worth area of espionage agents. Peter Gregory was with Rena Oswald the day that Lee Harvey Oswald was shot, and he took her to the Secret Service where his friend Mike Howard took over. Mike Howard is the agent assigned to Rena Oswald through Peter Gregory, who attended Lyndon Johnson. He was with Lyndon Johnson the day that he died in Texas. Johnson had said just before he died that Oswald didn't do it, that Murder Incorporated had killed President John Kennedy. Peter Gregory was mentioned in Marguerite Oswald's testimony, the mother of Lee Harvey Oswald, as being in collusion with Rena Oswald, very cozy, after the death of her son, and he knew that they were agents working together. The very first person in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, one of the first that Lee Harvey Oswald contacted, the first he called was Max Clark. He got the name allegedly from Peter Gregory, but Gregory can't confirm that. They don't know how he got Clark's name. That was the chief of Convair out at, for the FBI and Defense Intelligence Agency out in the Fort Worth area. Max Clark was Oswald's first contact. His second was Peter Gregory. Gerald Ford listened to that testimony. The next testimony he listened to was Catherine Ford. Catherine Ford is a woman that met Rena Oswald through the Gregories, that set up an introductory party that was connected to people who were from the Army intelligence in the United States, military intelligence, and it was Catherine Ford that went with Rena Oswald and Isaac Don Levine, Richard Nixon's great historian, who's worked with him through many, many years of American history in and out of the White House. They went to a lawyer shortly after Oswald was killed to set up financial arrangements for Rena Oswald. Catherine Ford is the lady whose home Rena Oswald shared for a short while after the Secret Service released her. It was Catherine Ford Representative Congressman Ford, Gerald Ford, went to hear that testimony. Maybe they're cousins. Who knows? I don't know that much. And Michael Payne. I've talked about Michael Payne before, the third-generation Harvard nuclear physicist, designer of helicopters at Bell Aerospace. The man who managed Bell Aerospace was Mr. Dornberger, the Nazi that I've mentioned on many, many shows on KLRB that the British said belonged on the junk heap at Nuremberg. He was in place, set in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Michael Payne worked for him. And Michael and Ruth Payne were very closely related to the entire espionage operation of Lee and Rena Oswald. And it was Michael Payne who took Oswald to General Walker's meeting just shortly before the assassination of President John Kennedy. This Michael Payne, Catherine Ford, and Peter Gregory were the only three witnesses that Congressman Ford, Gerald Ford, attended their testimony out of 34. And yet, he wrote a book called The Portrait of an Assassin, which is a totally fictitious book, based upon witnesses' testimony 31 that he never heard. And I spent 8 years cross-filing that. Now, this is important because when you read about Mr. Ford in the newspaper, and there's been a lot of articles since the last few days his name was nominated as vice president, they never associate him with a John Kennedy assassination investigation. They talk about his being a war hawk. They talk about his being against civil rights. There's a question about money, oil money from Maine that's been siphoned through his pockets. There's been a lot of talk about his intensified bombing of North Vietnam. He was an all-out hawk. His being a protege of Melvin Laird. All of these things are important, but to me, nothing is more important than the perversion of history and the turning around of the actual history, which is what he helped to do. He was involved with a lot. John Shaheen of New York City, who heads an oil firm and wants to build large refineries in Maine, he gave a $3,000 check, a campaign donation, which Congressman Ford failed to report. We know how many donations these people failed to report. How many did they fail to report that we don't know about them? At the time of the Supreme Court nomination of Mr. Poff, Gerald Ford gave a speech, and he said it is a sad and shocking day in American history when leaders of the NAACP and organized labor and a few hungry senators can prevent an honorable and fair and qualified man from having his name submitted. Mr. Poff had denounced the Supreme Court decision outlawing segregated schools. He opposed civil rights, and Gerald Ford thought it was a bad day when a few hungry senators and leaders in the NAACP can block such a fine nomination. There's a lot of things I could say about Congressman Ford. They're all negative. But my specialty is political assassinations, and he was a member of the Warren Commission. Now, he did make a statement, and this is what I think you should write to the Senate Judiciary. Congressman Ford made one statement a while back. First, he put down anybody who investigated the Warren Report. In 1966, he said that he's seen no new evidence been introduced which would cast any doubt on the Warren Commission. He said there's only one answer to the question of is there a conspiracy, and the answer is no. And then he went on to say anybody who thinks there is a conspiracy is doing a disservice to the memory of the late president. But let me make this clear about Gerald Ford. He said this, and he said on November 23rd, 1968, that was 5 years after the death of President Kennedy, John Kennedy. And he said, there are criticisms in books and articles dealing with the Warren Report, and they're all speculative. In none of these articles have I seen any new evidence whatsoever. At such times as I may see any new evidence, I would be glad to examine it or have responsible authorities or some group other than the Warren Commission consider that. Now, that is the area that I think people should write to the Senate Judiciary or the Rules Committee and say, he has said in 68 that if any new evidence appeared, he would examine it. Because there is massive evidence. There's 109 books out now on the John Kennedy assassination. There is a lot of evidence of crossfire, of more than one gun, and ballistic information. So I think we should take him up on that. And a contingency of his accepting the vice presidency would be that if he became president or as vice president, would he block the investigation into the Warren Commission report. A lot of people don't see it as important as I do, but I think it's very important to find out what happened in Dallas in 1963. I can't talk this week about the Howard Hughes money servicing. I want to. His remarks about buying the president, I'll go into that next week. There isn't time. I really want to go into the subject of what I call the golden triangle of political conspiracy in our state of California that's coming into Carmel, that connects up to the northern area in Santa Cruz. On many, many shows, I've talked about it at random on different aspects of what I call the Golden Conspiracy. And I want to talk about it today because the news is filled with that, the San Francisco and local papers. I'll state my premise. You don't have to agree with it if you don't want. This is what my research tells me, and we'll go into the evidence. I say there is a war going on inside the United States that can be fully documented if the law enforcement, proper people want to see it, citizen groups. It's conducted by the armed forces, the special forces, the local police departments working with the Attorney General, Evel Younger. It involves district attorneys such as Mr. Curtis in Monterey, Peter Chang in Santa Cruz, and John Ferdin in San Francisco. Its purpose is to come down against hippies, Panthers, blacks, and minorities, and Chinese youth groups in San Francisco. The Department of Army, the technical manual on unconventional warfare devices and techniques that was used by the militant Minutemen in San Diego, operates on this peninsula and up and down the coast. And the rash of mass murders that we see on up and down the coast of California, such as the Sharon Tate, LaBianca, the Dr. Oda family, the Santa Cruz mass murders, the Mullen, the Kemper, the Judge Haley shootout, the court shootout at Marin County, the San Quentin shootout, the Chinatown murders are all involved in this particular domestic intelligence operation. I am getting angry at the amount of material coming being put together, and I'm hoping that people in each of the communities that hear this tape will begin to get into this information and expose it more. There's a massive propaganda effort going on now because the trial of the San Quentin Six is going to take place soon in San Francisco. I've talked about that shootout on many, many radio shows. It is one of the most important trials in California because the prison system is on trial. Does the prison kill its own guards to get a selected group of radicals that they want imprisoned or given the death penalty or jail for life? That may sound ridiculous or horrendous, but we do send perfectly good young men to Vietnam. 45,000 died there for the sake of some bank accounts or oil in Vietnam or contracts, Brown and Root, cement, roads, aerospace equipment, ammunition. We do kill a lot of young men for this thing. We have young men going into the Middle East now, perfectly good young men for the profit and the power of a handful of people. And guards and policemen are killed when necessary to bring a cultural change on the general community. And this is what you're going to see. The article that I finished in July in the New Realist, which is on sale here at the Thunderbird, the Aries in Santa Cruz, and up in San Francisco, I talk about the violence that would come out as a San Quentin trial goes to the court, and it's going now. The effect upon the violence is to get certain leaders, political leaders, some of the more brilliant ones like Angela Davis, Rochelle McGee, Hugo Pinnell, George Jackson, the writers, the organizers, to get them dead and tucked away so we don't have an effective revolution, just like you get Che Guevara and Howard Hunt wanted to kill Castro. The same thing is happening in our country with the minority leaders. Hidden behind this overt plan of killing is two excuses, narcotics and mental health. That's why Casper Weinberger came out west, and he's going nationally to combine agencies of mental health and drugs. It's a very dangerous combination because people with mental problems can be programmed or conduced into a system that where violence comes down to prove a certain point in society. Edmund Kemper has been charged with these mass murders in Santa Cruz. His trial is starting. John Fraser was charged for mass murders of the Oda family and their secretary up there. Lawrence Kwong was recently committed suicide involving that shootout at KGO that we've talked about for the last couple of weeks. All three of these men had trips to Hawaii. All three were accompanied by females. And I understand it was Mr. Kwong who said that he had been kidnapped. On our own local peninsula, there is a murder incorporated. I think of a particular person. There's many of them, I'm sure, connected with Fort Ord, works with the local police, is a, in quotes, narcotic agent, heavily armed, a racist who detests blacks, openly says he wouldn't hesitate to kill them, well-financed, family man, two children of family, his wife and he go separate ways, like Mr. Howard Hunt and his wife, agents. Where does their money come from? Not just where he's earning it. He's earning in a certain position in town. He's very wealthy, home with swimming pool and horses and large grounds. Where no uniform where he's involved. Do hit the weapons that he have match any of the bullets found on the peninsula? I pose these questions because these conditions exist in the Carmel-Monterey area. We had a murder, a double murder, this last week since we were on the air, and the murder is linked to the San Quentin Six. It makes me a little nervous and anxious, because particularly since it was a black man with a white woman. I have many friends that are black. It was close in the geographical area where I lived, at the base of Los Laureles Grade. And the motive was a cover story right away. It was narcotics. And then after a few days, they tried to link it with the San Quentin Six, which is a provocateur lie. And this September 7th group, this guerrilla movement, I'm going to go in as much as time allows, is a front for a lot of violence that's going to come down now between now and the trial of the San Quentin Six. The very first day of the double murder on the 10th of October, the news said a man and woman were found at Los Laureles Grade, a road connecting to Carmel Valley just below there on the road towards Salinas. It was an execution-type shooting of a man, 37, a woman, 20, and Captain Henry Gilpin of the Sheriff's Office says they were apparently shot at sight. No weapon, no shells or casings were found. Their hands were bound. The man had on no shirt. He was in trousers, and the woman was in a lavender pajama outfit. They left the bodies there with no attempt to hide the victims. They wanted them found. That same day in the evening news, that was the morning news, the evening says Monterey County Coroner Harvey Hilburn says, this whole thing is narcotic-oriented. I always get suspicious when the clue to the murder is discussed. I remember Cynthia Ann Schell from Santa Cruz. She was the witness of a defendant in a narcotics bust up there. The man was deliberately framed. She knew the provocateur who worked with the police department and would have mentioned him. She was cut up and linked to a massive amount of deaths up in Santa Cruz with Mr. Kemper, Edmund Kemper, blamed for them. I don't like it when the motive is absolute. It says the whole thing is narcotic-oriented. The next day, on the 9th of October, the Seaside Police said he was a major heroin dealer, and they located the name of the woman with him, who was Faith Trumper. They said that he was part of a large dragnet operation where 48 suspects were brought in, and I thought about that dragnet in Santa Cruz where they were supposed to make a big bust, and the witness, one of the girls who could have proved a man innocent, Cynthia Ann Schell, was murdered. Murphy Anderson, it turned out by the next day, by the 9th of October, he was a black man and a white woman. They couldn't figure that out the first day. They had, I don't know what FBI reports they had to get to figure that one out. They knew the motive of the crime, but they couldn't recognize the colors of the two people involved. On the 10th, 2 days later, a guerrilla movement up in San Francisco and Oakland was claiming these deaths. The guerrillas claimed responsibility for the shooting, and the sheriffs acknowledged that there was a letter found near the scene of the murders. It's interesting that the August 7th, September guerrilla group from Oakland, California, if they left a letter by those bodies on the 8th of October, wouldn't have been seen by the 8th of October. But it took 2 days to admit that there was this letter found at the scene of the crime. I call that delayed evidence, maybe planted evidence, because I don't have much faith in that group existing at all, except to terrorize the community as they select the jury and go about the trial of the San Quentin Six. The local police say they don't know very much about this guerrilla group, and you better believe it, because Seaside and Monterey and Carmel do not have an August 7th black guerrilla group that's killing people in this manner, laying them by the grave. Now, Miss Trumpur, the particular woman, 2 days later, they found out where she came from. She came from Vancouver, British Columbia, and she had several different identifications with different ages and names. In my article in The Realist about the Stephen Bingham, the provocateur who set the motive for the George Jackson murder where he was killed, I mentioned he was from British intelligence. This may not be true, but later it turns out that Ms. Trumper could have seduced him, or she was used to get this particular man to the scene of the killing, and then they were both killed. She carried different identifications, different ages, and different names. It'd be interesting for some law enforcement agency who's objective to find out who printed her aliases and what work she did previously before she was found dead in Carmel Valley, outside of Carmel Valley. The sheriff's office said there are a number of suspects, but nothing positive. They're not going to investigate themselves, and I'm making a lot of strong statements, but you better believe there's nothing positive yet. Only thing they had positive was that the very first thing was narcotics-oriented. Once again, with every kind of a conspiracy where I think there's conspiracy involved, there's always the mystery weapon. They haven't found the nature of this weapon. The Monterey County Sheriff's Office won't speculate on what caliber a weapon it is. Now, the coroner says it was about a 38. It seems to me, looking at those bodies, one body had 6 bullets, the other had 7, that they could begin to tell what kind of weapons were used. But the police, again, are not talking about the weapon. And then a new motive came in, and the sheriff, while they have suspects, they're not revealing very much. And I know there isn't much to reveal, because I know this modus operandi, and what comes out is what you're meant to know, and not the whole story. In October the 11th, a few days later, the murder moved to Santa Cruz. The clothing and wallet were found along the beach. Mr. Anderson's clothing and wallet were found along the beach in Santa Cruz. And then the slayings were blamed again by the August 7th group, the guerrilla movement. Now they suggested there was kidnapping, that Ms. Trumper may have been held as a hostage. And they took her away. She was at a place. And there's evidence that they told Mr. Anderson that she was to meet him. And that he was living with her at her apartment, but she was taken away somewhere. He went to some friends to get some money. This is the newest part of the story. And when he was taken to where she was, evidently both of them were killed at the scene of the crime. And on the 11th, a letter was found near the bodies claiming the same group who killed the 2 policemen in a helicopter up in Oakland want the release of the San Quentin 6, that those men should be flown to Algeria or Cuba as part of a guerrilla movement and trying to link the deaths of 2 people in this area to 2 helicopter shootings, the shootdown in Oakland. They're trying to link these 2 together. Now, at the same time this was going on, the San Francisco Chronicle had received and the Berkeley Barb had received letters from supposedly from this guerrilla group, scary references. If you don't release the San Quentin 6, these deaths are taking place and they implicated the San Quentin 6. They want their freedom. I have a copy of a letter I wrote to Hugo Pinnell, one of the San Quentin 6 defendants. I want you to see it. Now, the same week, the San Francisco Chronicle has an article, a whole 4 columns, maybe 8 pages long, called The Bloody Tale of the Soledad Dragons. Now, Mr. Spiro Agnew, the ex-vice president, was talking today about the problem of getting immunity from a witness, that it's an invitation to perjury. Where has Mr. Agnew been, and what does he think goes on at these trials? There already are ex-convicts or convicts right now being offered parole to lie at the trial of San Quentin 6. I already know of one. I know his name. He was being hired or has been hired from the Los Angeles Police Department. In addition to hiring people to do perjury, to get a conviction on these men, the San Francisco Chronicle ran this article about a new book. The book is called A Melancholy History of Soledad Prison by Min Yi. And it had a large ad in the Chronicle this Sunday, along with this thing, tying in, again, it ties in the scare tactics of the San Quentin 6 and the dangers of these men. Now, the San Francisco Chronicle had this large article about the book by Stephen Cook. The movie Executive Action is being finished, and the book is out saying that there was a conspiracy to kill President John Kennedy. That doesn't make the news. The Glasshouse Tapes book is out with the conspiracy of California law enforcement up and down the coast doing just these kind of murders. And it mentions the killing of Jimmy Carr, which was one of their conspiracies tied into another trial of Rochelle McGee and Angela Davis. That doesn't make the news. The movie The Second Gun opened in New York City. That doesn't make the news. But a book talking about the Soledad killings and the San Quentin 6 and implicating the men for being responsible for the murdering of the guards and George Jackson, that gets Chronicle news at a time when the trial is getting ready to go out. What they said was, we won't sell the book in Marin County because they'd have an unfair trial, and the men already have a trial motion to have it moved from Marin. And there isn't anybody in Marin County who doesn't read the San Francisco Chronicle anyway. So there's this big article warning, and what they have is a quotation of Ho Chi Minh saying, people who come out of prison can build a country. Misfortune is a test of people's fidelity. Those who protest an injustice are people of true merit. When the prison doors are opened, the real dragon will fly out. And the name of the Chronicle article is Bloody Tale of the Soledad Dragons. Now, the book only interviews, according to the author, Min Yi, he only interviews prison guards and prison officials. And he only has the prison guard story. Mind you, this article just came out when they're beginning to get a trial going where men have been locked up in a dungeon, isolated for 23 hours a day, and won a fair trial in the Bay Area, and this book comes out, and the article's about the paper. Now, what does the article say? The author says, my prison sources were only the prison officials and the prison guards. Why? Minier says, in quotes, the radical sources started drying up, partly because the more radical element is not interested in truth. To them, it is almost irrelevant. That might be workable from a legal point of view, but not from historical or journalistic point of view. And I called to mind, there she or he is saying the radical element isn't interested in truth. And I think of books on the assassinations, like this Gerald Ford book, where he's writing a book about Oswald and didn't hear 31 of the witnesses who were involved with intelligence agencies and the CIA and Robert Oswald and Lee Harvey Oswald. Mr. Ford writes a book on that. Robert Houghton, chief of detectives of Los Angeles, has a lawsuit placed against him to stop the book Special Unit Senator because of its omissions and falsehoods about the death of Robert Kennedy. I mentioned last week that James Earl Ray has a lawsuit against Gerald Fink for a fictitious book on the death of Martin Luther King that's filled with falsehoods. The White House staff hired Howard Hunt and got 200 State Department papers to forge documents to blame a dead president, John Kennedy, for killing Diem over in Vietnam. And this author, this Minyi, has the nerve to say that the radicals are not interested in truth. And then the book sale, there's a great big ad. I measured it. It's 12 inches long by 3.5 inches wide with pictures of people lying down and blood drips all over, like the kind of stuff that came out when Manson had his trial. And we're talking about justice. Agnew's crying for justice in this country, and this article is disgusting. And at time, and meanwhile, in the newspaper, there was a pretrial motion to move the San Quentin Six last Friday from a California court to a federal, because the California officials here are so conspiratorially involved to get these men. They'd never have a fair trial. They need a federal judge and a federal court. But the time when they're fighting for their lives and to break through on some truth, all this is coming down against them. I wrote a letter to Hugo Pinnell. He's in San Quentin. He's a defendant of the San Quentin Six. I write to him every single day. He wants to tell me a lot of things that are going on there, but I tell him, you know, he would be killed if he told them to me. He should tell them to his lawyer before the trial starts. When I asked him about this book, because the book and the San Francisco Chronicle go out, they single Hugo Pinnell out, and they mention his name with George Jackson, saying, is my family coming that day, as if he's anticipating Bingham to come, as if he's part of a conspiracy because he asked for his family. Hugo wrote to me when I sent him a copy of that book review in the Chronicle, dated October the 11th, dear May, after 28 years of physically, mentally, spiritually, and morally overdriving my existence to resist against an inhumane, mechanical ruling class, I can hardly afford to get excited behind someone writing a crazy book. I won't react to that kind of bull. My voice has not been heard, has been heard ever since I started warning everyone that a great conspiracy was in the air. What are the chances of getting it heard now? Next time I speak out in the court, I hope, let it throw light on the overall issues involving everyone who really struggles in the question of freedom. How I despise politics, and yet we are in the midst of so many battles that the problem has to be considered through a political scope. Going back 5 years, I began to pay close attention to the administration's activities in order to understand why so much deadly games were being exercised against prisoners. Why was I going backwards? All the time I knew it was different. Why couldn't I move the so-called masses outside in society to build a firm bridge to establish communication with the inside? You see, this author is saying that the prisoners didn't want to communicate with the outside, and it's a falsehood because we correspond every day, and anybody who wanted to know what was happening could have seen those prisoners. Hugo Pinnell, I'll continue the letter, defendant in the San Quentin Six. Where were the answers? I started to write a book called The Great Conspiracy. I completed the book in 1971. This book reveals so much raw reality that after August 21st, 1971, when George Jackson was murdered and six were falsely accused of the crimes of killing prisoners and guards, this property was stolen. And up until this day, the authorities claim they don't know of such a book. I even raised the issue in court with court-appointed attorney Tarrant in Marin County. If you want something to broadcast about, talk about this book. How did I become a victim of so many frame-ups in such a little time? What did I do to get such a terrible record without myself knowing of it? Well, at Folsom in the main line. In 1969, the administration expressed great compliments towards my person for good behavior, and I responded by doing almost a clean year without any infractions. I explained all of this in my book. And the administration was ready to murder some defenseless prisoners in the O-Wing exercise yard, and they hesitated at first. This is when all that violence came down at San Quentin. He wanted to talk about it, and they hesitated to murder these men. At first, they wanted insurance and support from all the power of the state and beyond the state to neatly justify their premeditated acts of violence. In 1970, they were ready to let go full blast. And in my book, I tell about it. How in the hell can this writer depict a picture so clear of the Soledad Prison and San Quentin murders when he has no basic knowledge of the inside world? He's talking about this book by Meunier. Anyone who understands will be able to tell that this man is full of junk. Why don't you push for the whereabouts of my book, and then you'll be able to consolidate the points out why the conspiracies in California to kill the prisoners and the differences in my articulateness before 1971 and the trouble I had expressing myself after 71. After the shootouts, Hugo Pinnell had headaches, tension, and brutality. He was beat up, hit on the head, chained, clubbed, stabbed, a combination of factors because he had this book. Another letter Hugo had written to me, and this was in September. There's sections from a letter he wrote. I can't understand these American people. The dreams which they possess are only imaginary versions of what they hope to make a reality. Maybe they enjoy this illusionary life. I happen to think that there are many people out here listening to me who don't necessarily enjoy an illusionary life, but they have nowhere to go. If you read the paper today, the prison system, the big recommendations for prison systems to stop building all prisons for the next 10 years and all juvenile prisons and to let men out after 5 years. There are people working out there, and I think you should write to the Department of Corrections, Raymond Procunier, P-R-O-C-E-N-I-E-R, Raymond Procunier at the Department of Corrections, or write to the warden at San Quentin Prison and ask them why they have to brutalize the defendants in these important cases, why they can't let them go to court as gentlemen and provide the information that proves their innocence, and why they're spreading terror around the community with these cover stories. This, I know that this guerrilla movement, this August 7th group that they made up, is a provocateur type of situation to affect the jury in San Francisco, to scare people in the community, to use the press as an intermediary, and to turn the police and guards against the blacks and minorities and potential revolutionaries. At the time of the Angela Davis trial, there were shootouts of a gentleman on the courthouse to affect the trial of the jury, and James Carr was killed. At the time of Michelle McGee trial, there was a parts of a body were spread up at Santa Cruz to scare the jury, and it had to do with the Kempner murders, and they found a body of Cynthia Schell strewn up. Part of her was a Big Sur, and part of it was Alameda. And now they're trying with the San Quentin 6 trial to connect it down to Carmel to the black murder of a black man with a white woman and the two policemen in the helicopter. The law enforcement up in Oakland and the military people don't believe that these black guerrilla group brought down that helicopter at all. And I don't believe the group is doing all this. Based upon my research, I believe these are provocateurs trying to link a pattern of Panthers, radicals, and trials going on up and down the state that don't have a connection, where innocent men are trying to get out, and the Chronicle's carrying stories, the underground press is carrying these letters from the guerrilla movement, and I don't think people are buying the terror technique that they would years ago, but keep your eyes open and write to the Rules Committee about our new vice president that they want, Mr. Ford, and write to San Quentin and ask them to leave these men alone and let them have a trial and quit spreading terror around the prison and on the streets in their name. Well, our time is up. I will see you next week. take care and read the paper carefully and keep up with what's happening.